Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. My name is Joe Epstein, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for tonight's program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information as well as podcasts of past programs. And now on to today's program. More and more, the dangerous nature of professional football and contact sports at all levels is coming to light. In October, a PBS Frontline documentary and accompanying book entitled League of Denial, the NFL, Concussions and the Battle for Truth, raised eyebrows in addressing the severity of concussions among NFL players and questioning how the league has dealt with these issues. League of Denial asserts as factual that the NFL, over a period of nearly two decades, sought to cover up and deny mounting evidence of the connection between football and brain damage. And tonight we will explore this further with the two journalists who broke the story. ESPN investigative reporters and brothers, Mark Fanaru-Wada and Steve Fanaru. Let me just say a little bit about each of them. Mark Fanaru-Wada joined ESPN in 2007 as an investigative reporter for ESPN's Enterprise Unit, which is charged with developing long-form investigative features to be presented across multiple platforms. He contributes to all aspects of ESPN's news and information program, including SportsCenter and Outside the Lines. Previously at the San Francisco Chronicle, the work of Mr. Fanaru-Wada and colleague Lance Williams on the Balco steroids case earned them a string of national honors. In 2006, he and Lance Williams published Game of Shadows, Barry Bonds, Balco, and the steroid scandal that rocked professional sports, which prompted Major League Baseball to launch an investigation into steroid use in its sport. Mr. Fanaru-Wada previously covered sports for the San Francisco Examiner and Scripps Howard News Service. He's a graduate of Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Steve Fanaru is a senior writer for ESPN's Investigative and Enterprise Unit. And in 2010, he helped launch The Bay Citizen, an award-winning online news organization based in San Francisco. And Mr. Fanaru served as the publication's managing editor for news and as interim editor-in-chief. He previously worked as a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting for a series on private security contractors in Iraq. He is the author of Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, and the co-author of The Duke of Havana, Cuba Baseball, and The Search for the American Dream. And I'm also pleased to introduce today's program moderator, Joan Ryan, former San Francisco Chronicle columnist and noted author. Joan was a pioneer in sports journalism as one of the first female sports columnists in the country. She covered every major sporting event from the Super Bowl and the World Series to the Olympics and championship fights. Her sports columns and features earned 13 Associated Press Sports Editors Awards and the Women's Sports Foundation Journalism Award, among other honors. So here we are, time for an exciting program. Please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Mark Fanaru-Wada, Steve Fanaru, and Joan Ryan.
Thanks, Joe. It's so great to be sharing this with you guys. I've read the book is terrific. And the first question I have for you is, why do you call September 28th, 2002, one of the most significant dates in the history of American sports?
Mark. So that's the day that Mike Webster, who's a former Pittsburgh Steelers center, he's a a central part of the story of the book, the early part of the book. And Webster was one of the greatest players to ever play the game, one of the best centers perhaps ever in sport in football. And Webster had died a few days earlier. And it's on September 28, 2002, that Webster's body ends up on the autopsy table at the Allegheny County Coroner's Office. And it's the moment in which the story changes for the NFL. It's really the moment of truth for the NFL. It's where the story launches for them, and they end up in, you know, this concussion crisis. And the time that Webster shows up on the autopsy table, the guy working as the junior pathologist in that office is a doctor named Bennett Amalu. He's a Nigerian-born guy who is actually our favorite character in the book, I think. And Amalu knows nothing about football. He wouldn't know a Super Bowl from anything. He just doesn't know what football is. And, in fact, when he's told that Mike Webster, this legend in Pittsburgh, is on the autopsy table, Amalu's first question is, who's Mike Webster? And his colleagues are aghast that he has no idea who it is. But Amalu is an incredibly inquisitive guy, very well educated, who's just completed his studies in neuropathology. And he's heard a little bit that Mike Webster's life has deteriorated considerably before his death at the age of 50, to the point that Webster had become almost a different person than he had been, really unrecognizable to his family. And in that moment, on that day, Amalu makes the decision to study Webster's brain. He opens up his head during the autopsy. He looks at Webster's brain and expects that he's going to see sort of a shriveled up Alzheimer's-like brain, but it's normal, actually. But Amal is a curious guy, and he decides, I'm going to save that brain and study it. And it's that decision that really changes the course of the NFL.
So what happens when he studies that brain, Steve?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, just the idea of saving a football player's brain for study was something that really was unheard of at the time. And so, you know, it almost took a guy like Amalu, who was completely, literally foreign to professional sports, the NFL, the whole culture around the NFL, to do it. And, you know, he goes to his boss, a very colorful character named Cyril Wecht, who somehow has managed to insinuate himself into pretty much every major murder case dating back to the Kennedy assassination. And Amalu asked Weck permission to save Webster's brain. And Weck's response is, whatever, Bennett, just make sure you make me fucking famous. So he's saved.
Can we say that on the radio? It's
really, we're like 3 minutes into it, right? Believe it. So Amalu ends up literally putting Webster's brain in a basically a tub of formalin, a bath of formaldehyde and water, so that it hardens, and then he can slice it almost literally like pound cake, and then shave it into slivers that can be examined under a microscope. And you know, he's not sure what really is going to happen, except that, as Mark said, Webster had gone literally crazy, and you know, he expected that there was something going on. Interestingly, and this is also part of the book, he had studied the brain of a battered woman who had died and had discovered that she had had traces of this protein that is a signifier of neurodegenerative disease, particularly in Alzheimer's cases and other diseases. And so it was sort of in the back of his mind, and that was one of the reasons why he saved the brain. So he gets it under the microscope, and he begins to look at it, and he begins to see these traces of this tau protein, which is an abnormal protein that develops and forms tangles in cases of neurodegenerative disease. It literally, these tangles literally strangle your brain cells. Mm. And he's seeing them in places of the brain where you normally wouldn't associate with Alzheimer's or any other neurodegenerative disease. And he's also not seeing traces of beta amyloid, which is another biomarker of Alzheimer's.
And it's strange, too, because Webster's only 50.
Right, and Webster's 50. And so just to see this advanced case of neurodegenerative disease is super unusual. Mm-hmm. So Amalu doesn't even have his neuropathology certificate at this point. He's basically a student, right? I mean, he had just come out of his studies. He's this super eccentric guy who, he is kind of viewed with suspicion around the office. You know, he thinks that he can talk to the dead. You know, he communicates with the people who are on his autopsy table, and you know, he's sort of he's this guy who is sort of he's extremely religious and Roman Catholic, and he kind of fuses that with Igbo tribal mysticism from his native Nigeria, and so you know, he's not sort of like the run-of-the-mill guy in the office, and so he sees this and he takes it to his mentor at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, which of course is a very renowned institution, and he asks him to look at the slides and ask him, what do you think this is? Like, what do you think this case is? He doesn't tip him off at all. And so first, his mentor looks at it, and he thinks it's maybe something called dementia pugilistica, which mm-hmm. is a boxer's disease that had been found in 1928. And so he guesses that that's what it is. He says, well, was this guy a boxer? And Amalu says, no, it was Mike Webster. It was an NFL player. It was Mike Webster. And the guy's jaw literally drops. And he knew immediately that this was like, as he describes it, as like a billion-dollar finding. It was the first case of an NFL player who had been diagnosed with this disease. It was the first, you know, now there have been literally dozens of cases. It was the first case, and he knew, as many of the people who later examined those slides, that the NFL was in big trouble over this.
So this is kind of a grenade into that. And just to frame the stakes here for even people who know the NFL, 85 million avid NFL fans, that's a quarter of the nation. $1.9 billion per year the NFL makes from ESPN alone for Monday Night Football. That's $112 million per game, and I like how you guys frame it as that's like a Harry Potter movie. I mean, you could make a Harry Potter movie every week for what ESPN pays just for Monday Night Football.
Right.
So this is what we're dealing with. And to underscore its position as the 500-pound gorilla in the sports world,
right,
at the last minute on Frontline, ESPN, your employer, pulled its name.
You're just going right at it. You're not going to wait.
I'm going right at
just
it.
Like, let's just deal with
I
this
know,
right now.
I know, even though you're my friends. You
let's
know.
Just deal with it right now.
They pulled
all
their
right.
name, yeah. supposedly right. under pressure from the NFL, you know, just to show how powerful this entity is. And so I'm wondering how that landed with you, and did it change how you guys went about your business? And obviously you're still working for ESPN.
Right. Today.
Right. Today. Not after this is on. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so as you can imagine, it landed not well. You know, we had spent, you know, the backstory is Steve and I launched the idea to do the book about 2 years ago, or a little over 2 years ago. And in the course of doing that, we ran into one of Steve's old bosses at the Washington Post, a guy named Phil Bennett, who had become the managing editor at Frontline. And Phil said, you know, this is the kind of thing Frontline should do. And one thing led to another, and we were suddenly in a partnership with Frontline, who was going to work on a documentary based on the book. And so we spent, and then ESPN, upon finding out that Frontline was going to do a documentary, suddenly said, hey, we want to be a part of this too. They hadn't bought the book, but they had wanted to be a part of the project. So for 15 months, we had an amazing partnership with Frontline and ESPN and us, frankly, in which we were producing stories that, you know, we were doing all the reporting for the book, and then as the reporting was happening, we were breaking off stories that were newsworthy, that ESPN was really interested in, that Frontline was interested in for their website. And so there was a collaborative effort that produced a string of several big stories that got a lot of attention, and Frontline loved because their website went crazy, because ESPN's website is absurd in terms of the numbers of hits and all that. So it was an ideal partnership for 15 months, and the film was almost done but not done when suddenly we got a call from our bosses saying, hey, ESPN is no longer going to be a partner, co-producer in the film. And, you know, I think it was, you know, a shock to both of us. I think along the way, Steve and I would have conversations with each other about, like, does everybody really understand what's happening here? Like, you know, this is going to come to a head. And I think, you know, this all happened around the time the title of the book and the film finally made its way into the public domain. You know, League of Denial, it's not exactly the great title for the NFL to hear. There was a clip of one of the main doctors and characters in the book, Anne McKee, saying she feared that every single player she studied was going to end up having this disease. So in the end, it was a horrible turn of events. You know, the New York Times subsequently reports that ESPN pulled out under pressure after a meeting between the head of ESPN and Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the league. You know, any journalist would cringe at that, which we did and more. And we went to Bristol, you know, to talk about this and express our concerns. And ultimately what happened, and, you know, we were reassured, look, yes, this is an issue. We're pulling out of it. It's not about pressure. You know, and we just sort of nodded. But the thing that Steve and I have said throughout, which is reassuring, is ultimately nothing changed. The journalism stayed exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The book was already done, frankly. We're almost done, right? And the film didn't change a lick either. And ESPN, to its credit, as they said they were going to do, publicized the heck out of the film and the book. They ran excerpts of the book in the magazine. We were on a number of different ESPN shows when the book came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're still, as you said, employed by ESPN. We're still covering the story. We have a story on the NFL and concussions coming out on Sunday, which the league's not happy about. So, you know, it was not a pleasant experience, and, you know, we would have loved for it to end up differently. But the reality is none of this would have happened without ESPN. I mean, we had the unbelievable support of our bosses, and, mm-hmm. There is no book without ESPN, really.
So 7 years before Omalu's discovery, the NFL had already put together a concussion committee. What did that committee do?
Well, I mean...
And who was on the committee?
So the NFL in 1994 formed what they called the Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee. And it was in response to a number of concussions that had taken place in the NFL. Several prominent players had either been literally knocked out of the game for good, or they had suffered really severely debilitating concussions, including Al Toon, a wide receiver for the Jets, and Merrill Hodge, who's a running back for the Steelers and then the Bears, and of course later Steve Young was, you know, retired because of concussion. And so there was an enormous amount of publicity around this. The league, the commissioner, Paul Tagliabue at the time, was publicly skeptical about the whole thing. I mean, he called it a media creation of the media. It was like a non-story that was created the media. And there's this one classic scene where he's speaking at the 92nd Street Y, where ironically Roger Goodell was just there this week, denying, too, that there was really, really an issue. But Tagliabue was the 92nd Street Y getting interviewed by David Halberstam, you know, of course, a famous journalist formerly of the New York Times who had been in Vietnam. And so Tagliabue starts spouting these statistics about how, you know, like one concussion every 22,000 plays or something like that. And he's spouting statistic after statistic. And Halberstam stops him in midstream and says, "You know, I feel like I'm back in Saigon listening to McNamara spout statistics about Vietnam." But nevertheless, Tagliabue creates this committee, and he appoints to head it not a brain scientist, but a rheumatologist who also happens to be his personal physician. So this creates, understandably, alarm bells around, particularly in the neuroscience community. Like, what the NFL, with all its power and resources, what are they actually doing? You know, so this guy, the rheumatologist Elliot Pelman, headed this committee, and then they packed it with NFL doctors who were the same people who had been sending the players back on the field for years. So for the next 15 years, basically, they put out paper after paper, scientific paper. Basically denying that concussions were a problem in the National Football League. They stated categorically that NFL players don't get brain damage, as if they're like superhuman, like they have superhuman brains that are somehow, you know, that their brains are as muscled somehow as their as the rest of their bodies.
But didn't they say that if you get to the NFL, it means that you're not prone to concussion?
Yeah, like as if there's some, you know, there's some Darwinian process that prevents your brain from being, you know, susceptible to this kind of trauma. And they did this over and over. And then, of course, parallel to that, and this is a large part of our book, there are a number of neuroscientists, including Bennett Omalu and several other people, who are now studying football and head trauma and the effects of it, and finding out that, in fact, there are serious signs that this is a major problem for the NFL. Higher rates of depression, higher rates of dementia, higher rates of Parkinson's disease, and all kinds of signs that, you know, something is seriously amiss. And the players themselves are reporting back in surveys, and they're telling people this. And at the same time, the NFL, this committee, is basically using the NFL's public resources, or its, you know, its media resources, to basically just trash these people.
Mm-hmm.
You're wrong. The evidence is flawed, to the point where the league, under pressure, funds its own study, and they find that. It was at University of Michigan, and they find that the incidence of dementia among NFL players was like 19 times higher than the general population. And so now they're in the position of answering this for their own study, and they basically like trounce their own study. So now they're like, they're making public statements against their own work. So it became, you know, sort of almost comical, and that's when Congress and people like us began to step in.
And as you mentioned, Goodell just said on Monday that, you know, there's absolutely, you know, no cover-up, you know, nothing.
Right.
But
he said, we're the leaders.
We're the leaders.
Right. He said, we've been the leaders on this issue.
In investigating this. And
right, yeah. He also said they put together a committee of independent experts who looked at the problem.
Well, there are respected neuroscientists and neurosurgeons who do agree with Goodell, that say it's not an absolute certainty that there's a cause and effect, that football causes brain damage. I mean, the UCSF, Mitch Berger here at UCSF, Michael Collins at the University of Pittsburgh, where all of this kind of started. So how do you make sense of that?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't know. As we spend a lot of time with a lot of those folks, obviously, and I've come to view, I mean, I think when you look at the statements that are being made now about this issue, for the most part, you know, what you see is, you know, I think, yes, there are people saying, well, you can't definitively make the connection yet because we don't have a long-term study that sort of looks at players from the point in which they, before they got into the league and then through the league and then died. But I think, generally speaking, there's an acceptance that hitting your head repeatedly can potentially cause brain damage. I mean, that's been in the literature, as we talked about, with dementia pugilistica since 1928, I think it is. So I think the debate now largely, though you still do have Roger Goodell saying, we're going to let the medical people decide this, which is what he said 4 years ago in front of Congress. I think many, if not most, of the medical people around this issue accept the idea that this is potential and a problem. But rather, the real question is around prevalence. Mm-hmm. And whether there are other contributing factors that lead to this. Are some players more genetically predisposed to this? Are there some influence from using substances, steroids, whatever, that are making it worse for certain players and others? And then real questions around what actually is the prevalence of this disease? How many players are actually going to get it? I think those, to me, those are the real questions that mm-hmm. are still happening. I think most neuroscientists accept the premise that, especially in football, given that the helmet is actually really more of a weapon than it is. I mean, the helmet was designed, there's a whole section in the book around the helmet, and the helmet was designed and it's done a really good job of protecting against skull fractures. That's what its purpose was. But it wasn't designed with the thought of concussions. And in fact, for the purposes of concussions, it doesn't help at all. And in fact, I think a lot of people believe universally that it makes things worse because mm-hmm. players see the helmet as protecting themselves, and it's clearly become weaponized.
Mm-hmm. And you know, that was a question, whether there's like a super helmet that possibly could.
Right.
Well, the committee thought they could.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the committee's big idea was that they were going to create this like concussion-proof helmet. And of course, immediately many neuroscientists were suspicious of that. It was sort of, you know, kind of a naive notion, considering this is an injury that occurs inside your head. And so, you know, there's still a lot of debate around, you know, helmeting and whether that can somehow affect this. But I think most people have sort of moved on from that, and there's, you know, there's sort of more debate. The one thing I would add is that, and I think this is what you hear from a lot of people now, is that the brains of 54 NFL players have been examined by neuropathologists. And, of course, this is a disease that can only be diagnosed after death. Of those 54, 52 of those players have had...
50, right?
52. Huh. 52 players have had this disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And so that alone, I think, for many neuroscientists, is very persuasive that there is something going on here. Now, as Mark said, like, what the prevalence is, we don't know. It's a very self-selecting group. These are people who were obviously impaired, or their brains probably would not have been donated in the first place. And yet, the one common thing that they have is that they all played professional football, many of them for, you know, for a prolonged period.
Have they done studies on the military? Because unlike the NFL, they really have been leaders in brain trauma. And one of their studies found that it's almost the sort of low-level repetitive pounding of the brain that has created the higher incidence of suicide and depression and all that, not the huge traumatic brain injuries. So do you know if they've done studies, CTE, found the tau protein in the military, or they haven't? Have you heard if they've done those kinds of studies?
The military is doing that study. The NFL, in its efforts to say they're the leaders, is working with the military. And some of the doctors, what?
Just saying.
I'm a cynic. some of the doctors have, you know, Anne McKee, one of the doctors and neuropathologist in the book, has done work on military folks. Bennett Amalo has done some work on military, on soldiers posthumously. So, That is happening, and it's interesting because that actually, you know, what you're talking about, this notion of this sort of low-level repetitive nature, that is really that's where the science seems to be going, and it's of course the greatest concern for the league. You know, the league's focus has always been on how can they legislate out massive hits and concussions, obvious concussions. You know, the blow where a defensive back blows up a wide receiver that we all see replayed time and time again. But, you know, when you look at, like, a lot of the players who've been diagnosed with CTE is a high level of offensive and defensive linemen, and the theory is that just the repetitive nature of pounding on each other on the offensive line and the defensive line at the line of scrimmage on every single play exposes players in a way that's more so than if you're playing quarterback even or safety. So I think that, you know, and that cuts to the very essence of the sport. I mean, the idea of figuring out how to legislate that out doesn't seem reasonable, I think, to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. One question here I think is really interesting. So Aaron Hernandez is the player who's accused of murder, correct?
Yes,
is he in? I don't know if he's in jail yet or whatever. He's accused. Right. Do you think that the lawyers could use this as a defense? I mean, it's kind of an interesting...
I would be surprised if they don't.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, we just saw the case in Kansas City where there was a murder-suicide involving a player of the Kansas City Chiefs, and they're now trying to sue the, you know, he hasn't even been diagnosed, and they're trying to sue the Chiefs. It's the Chiefs, right? They're suing the Chiefs because, you know, arguing that he had suffered concussions, that he was pressured to play with those concussions, and that the Chiefs should have been aware of that. And, you know... I don't know what to really make of that, except for the fact that I think it really speaks to sort of where we are now. You know, that here's a guy who committed a horrific act, and there's no evidence at all that he had neurodegenerative disease, and yet his family already has lawyers alleging that he did and that the team was culpable. So, I mean, I wouldn't surprise me at all if it comes up in the Hernandez case.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that's...
But, of course, I think he's not admitting that he...
No, I think he's just...
Has done it.
Yeah.
So that
right.
makes it a little bit. I'm going to take this opportunity right now to remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the NFL concussions and the implications for everyone who plays sports with ESPN investigative journalist Mark Fainaru-Wada and Steve Fainaru. I'm Joan Ryan. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. One of the things that I was so struck at, and I've covered football, you know, for a long time, is the Pittsburgh Steelers nutcracker. Can you explain what the nutcracker is and why anybody would possibly do that?
Well, the nutcracker drill is essentially a drill. Coaches have described it sort of as a test of manhood, a test of will, really. It's a drill where two basically linemen or linemen and a linebacker line up facing each other, maybe a yard apart as they would at the line of scrimmage. Behind the offensive lineman is a quarterback and a running back. There's a gauntlet that's sort of set up where they're in a very closed amount of space, maybe 3 yards apart, I think. There's a sort of formality almost of the quarterback handing the ball off to the running back as if he's doing that, and then the running back is trying to get through the defensive player, basically, as if it's a running play. But what's happening really is you've got these two guys lining up right in front of each other and running into each other as fast as they possibly can. Gary Plummer, the former 49ers in the book, and he describes it as if it's like two Rams just slamming into each other, basically, over and over again. And these days the idea of doing the nutcracker is viewed as, obscene almost. You don't see teams really doing it, although it's funny. Steve and I were just in Houston doing a story about youth football, and we saw some kids running what looked like the nutcracker. But it's a rite of passage in the NFL, and the book opens really with the nutcracker drill. It was a common drill that was used in Pittsburgh and other places to start off the season. And Chuck Knoll, the coach of the Steelers, it was basically the first day of training camp, and fans would come out in droves to watch the Steelers, and they would all line up basically in almost this sort of gladiatorial mm-hmm. experience to watch the nutcracker drill. And this book opens with Mike Webster, fifth round draft pick, who nobody thinks is going to make the Steelers, this undersized lineman, going up against Jack Lambert. They're both rookies, and Jack Lambert is viewed as this, snarling, just evil, mean guy. And Webster dominates Jack Lambert in the nutcracker, and the coaches are frothing at the mouth and cheering him on, and all the offensive defensive players are there, and it's just a crazy scene of manhood.
Anne McKee. What did you say?
Let's demonstrate.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you mind?
We probably did it when we were like 10 and 7 or something, yeah. I think.
So as you said, that's kind of going the way of the gladiators. But as more and more of the CTE is found in the players who were died and guys committing suicide by shooting themselves in the chest to preserve their brains. And, as one of the audience members, Favre, Dorsett, other guys who obviously are still alive saying, I've got the symptoms. Why or do you think that mothers, you mentioned youth football in Houston, are mothers and fathers going to continue to allow their children to play football given what we know now? It's like tobacco. Now that you know it caused cancer, you have a choice not to smoke. So now that we know this, what do you think will happen to football?
I mean, in many ways, it's already happening. So Mark and I did a story a few months ago for ESPN that showed that Pop Warner football had seen a participation drop of almost 10% over the last 3 years. We were, as Mark said, we were down in Houston doing this story, and Texas football, it's a different world than up here. The championship games for the 8 and 9 year old team were held in a 10,000 seat stadium with a big Diamond Vision screen.
Wow.
And, in 30 degree temperatures. And that league has 58 teams and 1,600 players. But, you know, it's just unheard of here. But they themselves had seen a 20% drop in participation.
Wow.
They had gone from 88 teams to 58 teams, you know, since 2008. And the people who run the league will tell you just straight out that a lot of it has to do with the concussion crisis. I mean, I really do feel that I think for, you know, so obviously for some people, it's reached a threshold where they're not, they don't want their kids to, the risk reward is too much. But I think that the science, as it has, as it's gotten us to where we are now, is going to determine that, the answer to that question. Because so right now, if we're at 52 NFL players who have been diagnosed with brain damage, and the prevalence turns out to be much higher than that, if we're in the hundreds or even the thousands, God forbid, you know, that's going to have a dramatic effect on who plays. And, you know, I think there's also a psychological thing going on that really hasn't, I'm not sure it's totally touched the sport from a popularity standpoint. You know, the NFL, I mean, as you said earlier, it's just so huge. I mean, it's, you know, 100 million people watch the Super Bowl. You know, the ratings for, I think we put this in the book, I think the ratings of the top 40, the top 25 rated shows on TV, like 24 of them are NFL games. So it's just huge. And but I do think that there is a certain, like, queasiness factor that is now coming into play. Mark and I talk about it all the time. You're like, what exactly are we rooting for? You know, when we root for the big hit, when we see what happens to these people who we embrace every Sunday and what the price is, you know, how, where exactly does that lead? And I don't think, I think the science will determine it ultimately.
Do you think people will stop watching knowing this? I don't think they will.
I don't, I mean, you know, Steve, we've had this discussion a bunch of times, and Steve's, I think we do see it a little differently. Not that we ever disagree, but I have a really hard time imagining that. I mean, I just, you know, I mean, Steve's point is like, well, if we get to a threshold where there's so many players that have it, that's going to change the way the sport is. And I guess that's conceivably true. I just, you know, it's such an ingrained part of our culture now. You know, it's as Steve has said many times, it's not like smoking. Nobody misses smoking now. Nobody misses the fact that you can't smoke in here anymore. You know, but people would, you know, a large segment of the population would miss football, including me. So it's hard. I mean, people say, oh, well, boxing was huge, you know, in an enormous way in the 50s, and now it's sort of this, you know, weirdly viewed sport. But I just don't see it as the same now that television has consumed us, and you know, it's a $10 billion industry. The commissioner's projected that it could be as much as a $25 billion industry in 10 years. So for me, it's just really hard to imagine. You know, I can see the game changing in some ways, but I just think it's such an ingrained part of our culture.
Yeah. You know what I also found when I was reading your book, and there was so much evidence for so many years how, we obviously know football's bad for you, but really how bad, you know, it went from North Dallas 40 to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know? That, where was the players' union in all of this? Why wasn't the players' union standing up to get more benefits, more protection for their own players?
I think there, you know, some people have suggested that the book should have been called, like, Nation of Denial. And I think the players' union falls into that category. You know, the head of the players' union, Gene Upshaw, stated publicly that this was not, he didn't believe that this was a major problem. And I think that the union's approach to that was, you know, flowed from that. You know, they just simply were not really engaged in it. You know, that said, I do think it's a little bit more nuanced than just that they checked out in the same way that the NFL did. I don't think it's the same thing. For one thing, the NFL literally created its own research arm to deny that this was a problem. The Players Association simply decided not to stand up for this cause. But the Players Association was directly involved in the funding and the creation of a research institute at the University of North Carolina that was a leader in the discovery of many of the implications about head trauma and professional football. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. But my own view, Mark and I have talked about this a lot. I think if we had had more time, we would have probably spent a chapter or two on the union mm-hmm. and why they were, you know, why they weren't as involved.
As long as you wrote it.
Yeah.
But I think it, my sense is that it would have been a more that it is a more nuanced thing than it was with the league itself.
And the timing, so the Frontline came out October, September?
October 8th.
So was it August or September that the NFL reached a settlement in the class action suit that many players... Can you talk about the class action suit and the money that's involved? Sounds like a big number.
Yeah, so in I think it's based on the eve of the season starting, you had more than 4,000 players, former players, suing the league, as well as their family members of some deceased players. So you had upwards of 6,000 people suing the league and arguing essentially what's detailed in the book, frankly, that the league had spent two decades denying this was an issue and shielding players from information that would have been useful to them to consider whether they wanted to continue playing and potentially would expose them to brain damage. And so on the eve of the season, the lawsuit was settled, or at least there was an announcement of a settlement in which the league was going to pay $765 million, which, as you say, does seem like a big number. It's not a small number. In the perspective, I think a lot of people criticized it because it's, again, a $10 billion industry. But it's been interesting to cover. Steve and I have covered the settlement ongoing, and it's really up until recently only been a settlement in name only. You had an announcement, but you had no details about actually what were in the settlement, and you had a lot of players growing exceedingly concerned that, A, there wasn't enough money in the deal, B, how would they get money? There were concerns about who was eligible. One of the most startling things, the pieces of information that we ended up finding out about the settlement, was the very players who had set off the whole concussion crisis, Mike Webster, Terry Long, another Steelers player who subsequently died also, and Bennett Amalu determined had CTE, Justin Strelzik, another Steelers player who Amalu studied and found to have CTE. Those guys were actually excluded from the settlement. So there's a lot of discussion right now about what's going to happen. The details were finally released the other day, and there remains a lot of questions around it. And so where we are now is the players are going to have the opportunity to talk to their lawyers and consider whether they want to accept the terms of the settlement or what's called opt out. And if they choose to opt out, then their cases can go back to the courts and be considered. They have a real uphill battle. I mean, one of the reasons that they settled, I think a lot of people believe, is because it's not an easy case to make, right? I mean, the case that you might have got, I think there's an established idea that you got brain damage from playing football that they think they could make. But did you get it from when you started playing college football? Did you get it from playing high school football? You know, on up. And so there were real questions, I think, for the players, and that's one of the reasons they settled, I think. But there's going to be unquestionably players who opt out. And I think both Steve and I view the settlement, some people see it as the end of the whole sort of legal. I think we both agree it's the beginning more than it is the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more litigation for sure.
Now, I recognize some of the names of the researchers and doctors in your book now have products or therapies or diagnostics that now they're pushing as a way to find this CTE before it's a post-mortem. And we have a question about that. You know, is there some progress in diagnosing? Tony Dorsett has announced he has it, right?
Right. So Amalu and a guy named Julian Bales, who was a very prominent neurosurgeon in Chicago, who was really Amalu's biggest advocate. Bales was actually a team physician for the Steelers for quite some time. And some other people formed a group with researchers at UCLA. They did a pilot study using a PET scan that had been previously used on Alzheimer's patients, and they claimed that they were able to detect in living patients the presence of this protein, tau, that is a marker for CTE. And so they believe that it's an indication that very soon there will be this test which would be both extremely significant scientifically and extremely lucrative for the people who are doing the testing, because mm-hmm. you can imagine the Pandora's box that would open up. You know, are players going to be are players going to be diagnosed before they begin playing? Are there going to be, is there going to be testing? Will high school players be tested? What are the civil liberties issues involved? I mean, there's just a whole range of real questions. Some people believe that the announcement of that was very premature. At the same time, the people who are the most skeptical are the same researchers who are themselves trying to develop this test in living patients. And so, you know, there's this furious competition going on. You know, one of the things that I've thought a lot about when there's this continuing question of the causation issue, like, well, is this really real? I mean, we're now at a point where there's like hundreds of millions of dollars pouring into this research from almost literally zero about, you know, 20 years ago. And so if it's not real, there are a lot of people spending a lot of money to try to get, you know, a handle on this. Mark and I, when we started to write stories for ESPN, it seemed like every week we would get an email from somebody who was peddling some new concussion product, you know, that would, you know, that would solve the whole thing, you know, whether it was like a Kevlar, like a Kevlar yarmulke almost, right? Like a,
yeah.
Yeah, like,
it was,
yes, that's right. Like a, you know, you know, there
what was
one,
the thing? Bales had
a thing where when you got hit, there would be a compression of your jugular vein, which would basically it would alter the flow of blood to your brain that would eliminate, you know, the slosh that occurs inside your brain when a concussion happens. Yeah, all kinds of, you know, insanity coming our way. And that's only accelerated. I mean, you know, one of the more serious things, you know, there's a real serious side to it. And, you know, we get into this some in the book. When the NFL did this flawed research, it was aimed in part at creating this concussion-resistant helmet. And Riddell took the data and then created it and marketed it as a product that could reduce concussions by 31% in kids. And then they sold millions of these helmets based on that claim. The FTC ultimately stepped in and investigated Riddell and concluded that there was no basis for this, you know, for this claim, that it was all like Riddell had funded their own study at University of Pittsburgh and then used that study to as the basis for their claim. And so, you know, we've always felt that that's one of the more insidious aspects of the whole thing. You know, they're marketing this stuff to kids and the parents who are trying to figure this stuff out, and there's a lot of that stuff going on now.
One question is, do NFL players have to sign something saying that if they die, they can't donate? I mean, has the NFL tried to ever get in the way of anybody's family donating the brain to get tested?
Well, it's interesting. They haven't. I don't know of them getting in the way of anybody doing it. There's a section of the book on Junior Seau and his death. And Junior Seau, for those of you who don't know, is one of the greatest players ever to play the game. He'll be a sure Hall of Famer. Played 20 years in the league at linebacker, perhaps the most violent position in the sport, and then subsequently has this tragic decline in his life, and then shoots himself in the chest. And what ends up happening, you know, and this is another byproduct of what's happened, is, you know, a war breaks out basically for Junior Seau's brain. You have all these scientists converging in San Diego, essentially, you know, either literally or figuratively, to try and get their hands on Junior Seau's brain to be able to study it and determine whether he has CTE. And two of the groups that are going after the brain are Bennett Omalu and his group, who we talked about, and Ann McKee. Now, Ann McKee works at Boston University, and Ann McKee has become, subsequent to Omalu sort of being marginalized in this issue over years, partly because of the NFL's efforts to sort of squash him and silence him, Ann McKee becomes the go-to person on studying NFL brains. She's a neuropathologist at Boston University, and she ends up studying more brains than any other neuropathologist of former NFL players. And McKee's group is trying to get it. And McKee's group, for a period of time, when the NFL suddenly is facing this issue in a huge way, they go before Congress, and Commissioner Goodell is just hammered at Congress. And subsequent to that, the NFL, scrambling seemingly for PR purposes, donates $1 million to Boston University for their research into brain study. And they also say, we're going to help you guys get brains. So when players die, we're going to facilitate that for you. Well, fast forward a year or two later, maybe 3 years after that, Seau has died. There's still a letter on the wall at Boston University from the NFL saying, we're going to help you get NFL brains.
That the NFL, that BU is the preferred brain bank
right.
of the NFL.
Right. However, when Junior Seau dies and McKee goes after the brain and Amalu goes after the brain, lo and behold, NFL folks step in and steer the brain away from Amalu and McKee and towards the NIH. And their argument is, look, we're just trying to help the science. The NIH is, they call them like Switzerland. They don't have a dog in this fight, and so we think the science will be better. A very legitimate argument that the NIH will be, no one's suggesting the NIH is going to do anything wrong, and in fact, when Seau's brain is diagnosed, he does have CTE. But to a lot of people, the message was, here's the NFL trying to control the science again, and really, in many ways, control the messaging. Because if Ian McKee or Bennett Amalu announced Junior Seau's positive test for CTE, they would have announced it in their way. And I think in this way you had, you know, we ended up breaking that story, and it was a big story that Seau had CTE, but you had doctors, in fact, one of the doctors for NIH is a doctor who was on a committee for the NFL related to concussions and brain trauma. So the NFL has insinuated itself into this issue continually, and that hasn't changed. And so, in fact, while they're not keeping people from sending their brains in, they, at least in Junior Seau's case, sort of stepped in and directed the science.
Well, in some ways, maybe it is helpful for the NIH to be involved because you don't feel like they have necessarily a vested interest. You know, and in reading the book, Amalu kind of, you know, everybody seems a little bit opportunistic.
Yeah, or more than a little.
Or a little more than a little yeah. opportunistic.
Yeah. This is an argument that Mitch Berger at UCSF made that BU has a vested interest in proving that this thing exists. They're getting research dollars, and that's, you know, self-evidently true. But at the same time, Stanley Prusner, who's a Nobel laureate researcher at UCSF, was among the researchers who was chasing Junior Seau's brain. And so I do think that there is this, it's undeniably, it's become a free-for-all. You know, there's so much money involved, mm-hmm. so much prestige that, that you almost do need a scientific referee to handle what's going on right now, especially for parents who are trying to sort out what the reality is, you know, is going on here. But, you know, I think one of the questions a lot of people have raised is, you know, should the NFL be that referee? You know, mm-hmm. as somebody said the other day, a former NFL player, you know, you don't want the tobacco industry, you know, determining sort of like the safety regulations for, you know, for smoking. And that's kind of what's going on now. And so it's just a mess. It really is. And I think that I don't see it getting any really, you know, any better, you know, because now you just have a flood of, you know, just almost every institution in the country is involved in this research. And every, you know, people's careers are being made.
Well, and then one place to start is to not have the doctors be on the payroll of that team, that somehow there has to be like NFL doctors or maybe NFL PA doctors, because they're the ones that are determining supposedly when a player goes back into the game. And a lot of them, as you account for in your book, you know, are the coaches telling them, no, we need that guy. All right, go back in. You know, I don't know if that's still happening now, but certainly that's been the history.
I mean, I think it's happening less, but I have always said, like in the sports realm of things, covering sports for so many years, I think that job is one of the hardest jobs anybody can have because it's so conflicted. It's just an inherently conflicted job, whether you're a team trainer or a team doctor. You know, you're employed by the team, which sole purpose is to get players on the field healthy and playing to perform and succeed and win. You're also a doctor, and you have an oath to your patient, who is the player in this case. And your goal is to provide the best possible health care and the best advice to that player. And those two ideas are inherently, you know, they're clashing like the Oklahoma drill. I mean, there is no resolution to that. And so, the NFL has done things now. There's on the concussion front, there are independent neurologists now who are supposed to be on the sidelines and are part of the process of evaluation. you know, but I think, you know, the argument is, I think the players, you know, the players also inherently have no idea who to trust within that whole realm of things. Do they trust the team doctor, even though that guy works for the team? Do they trust an independent neurologist who doesn't really know them and their bodies? I mean, I think it's a real, you know, and I don't think there's an answer to that issue.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add that, you know, to me, it's even harder for the players.
Right.
Because, you know, they are paid to play. And concussion, it's not like breaking your leg. I mean, it's an mm-hmm. invisible injury, really. And, you know, I mean, look at Alex Smith. I mean, I was at that game. Alex Smith suddenly disappears from the field. I have no idea, like, nobody in the stands had any idea, like, why he was gone. Had Harbaugh just replaced him with Kaepernick? And he, you know, like, it was very unclear. It turned out that he had reported his concussion, as he should. They removed him. Did he ever play again? He never played again for the 49ers. Mm-hmm. They shipped him off to Kansas City, and that was that. I mean, so, and this is, you know, unlike sort of at the peewee level and even high school, you know, and to a certain extent college, I mean, this is these guys' livelihoods. I mean, this is how they make their living and support their families. And so I just think from a player standpoint, and to me, that's one of the things that was so irresponsible about the NFL, that the players are going to play. That's mm-hmm. what they do. Mm-hmm. So, like, there have got to be adults in the room who are like, okay, we're going to protect you from yourself. Not like, oh, hey, don't worry, everything's okay. You know, don't worry about this study. Or, you know, it's just preposterous. And so, and you know, I do think there's a lot of progress that's being made. It's been at the point of a legal bayonet, but, you know, but it's, you know, for the people, like Mark said, I mean, for the doctors, for the players and, you know, the coaches, it's a hard one. It will not, that culture is not going to change.
How has the NFL responded, not specifically to your book, but we certainly have seen some marketing changes. We don't see the two helmets, you know, on the start of Monday Night Football or Sunday Night Football, you know, crashing against each other. What have you seen change in response to the public awareness of what's going on with the NFL?
You want to?
Well, you know, it's funny, like a day before, was it a day before our book came out?
Yeah. The
day before our book came out, or the day of the book came out and the Frontline documentary aired, the NFL sent out a letter to, like, all their fans, you know, tens of millions of fans, basically saying that they're taking a proactive approach, that safety is their number one concern, and, you know, there's been a lot of that. So there's a messaging issue that's definitely changed. And it's a huge shift for the NFL, which marketed the violence of the NFL for decades. And we get into this in the book, that a big part of the appeal of the NFL mm-hmm. is the violence and the brutality. And the NFL definitely played that up, along with ESPN and, you know, and the networks. I also think that they are trying to reassure parents that football can be made safe. And, you know, this has become a very controversial issue. It's sort of the next phase of this issue.
Steve, you might tell people to watch ESPN on Sunday.
Yes. If you're up at 4 o'clock in the morning. When is it? 6?
I don't know when it is.
So
but
outside the lines, we're doing a story on this on Sunday about the NFL's efforts to they've created this program called Heads Up, which basically, among other things, teaches what they say is proper tackling, and that if executed in the right way, will literally take the head out of the game. And so many players, you might not be surprised, have had the exact same reaction. Like, you know, like, what? And but this is what they're saying, and they're teaching it in like 2,700 youth leagues now. And so, you know, the NFL believes that this is sort of part of their ongoing effort to make football safer. And then some people are very cynical about that. And,
well, I mean, yeah. You guys have done more research and you're out in the field. Can it be made safe?
Me personally, I mean, I played it in high school and Mark has said this repeatedly, like, when you get on the NFL sideline, you're just like,
it's a totally different
game. You cannot believe
it.
It's like, it would be like flying over 880, you know, in a plane, like from 10,000 feet, well, and then standing in the median and watching their
progress. Yeah, that's the analogy, exactly.
It's like that's the difference between watching the game when you're standing on the field. You can't believe how fast and how strong these guys are. There's a part in our book, we were talking about it before the session, that you know, there's a guy who's a physicist at the University of Nebraska who set out to calculate the amount of kinetic energy that's generated at the line of scrimmage, the amount of destructive force, basically. And he's calculated that because of the changing size of the players, changing speed of the players, that the amount of kinetic energy at the line of scrimmage is effectively doubled in the last 50 years. Doubled. And he equated it to like firing firing a revolver chamber into the line of scrimmage. That's the amount of force that's being generated. The NFL's own studies has shown that you had players colliding at speeds of like 25 miles an hour.
And what is steroids, the rise of steroids, what has that done? I would think that there may be a correlation between brain injuries and the introduction of steroids into the NFL.
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know that the study's been done yet that looks. I mean, there's certainly studies that are looking at the changes in the size of players. Players have unquestionably gotten bigger, stronger, faster, and there's no doubt that steroids have become a part of the NFL. Although, having covered this issue for so long, I mean, it's interesting because the NFL has largely gotten a free pass on the steroids issue, and there's only, you hardly ever see guys test positive. They do occasionally, and the league is viewed as the sort of bastion of dealing with the issue, even though it just stands. I mean, my thing is always like, I look at players, they're not like us. They're like, this is not normal people. And they're some of the greatest athletes in the world. But you were alluding to this. When I stood on the sidelines for the first time of a 49ers game, it changed everything for the way I looked at the sport. Because it's not, I don't care how good HD gets. I don't care where you are on the field in terms of sitting. I don't care if you're up in the press box. It's a different sport. It is so fast, and it's so loud. And the plays that I was always struck by, the one thing that struck me more than anything when I was watching was, the plays that you watch on television where it's like a one-yard run, the guy just runs into line of scrimmage, he seems to fall down, and nothing happens. It's the scariest thing you've ever seen. Like, I don't understand how guys get up. I really don't. So, it's when the notion of where steroids play in creating all that velocity, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that that's changed the sport.
Why don't they test positive?
Well, you should read Game of Shadows.
I should remember what I read in Game of Shadows.
What a plug. That was a good plug, wasn't it? Even to this day, the guys who are experts in this field will tell you testing is much more an IQ test than it is an actual steroids test. That beating the system is still easy, relatively so, and that there's just any number of ways to use sort of lower doses or masking agents or whatever to sort of beat the system.
So they've figured it out.
I mean, of course, I'm as cynical as anybody on this issue, so I believe like everybody's using. But yeah. But in reality, I think that beating the system, I think, is normal course of business for many athletes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's next for you guys on this story? After the youth, I'm sure there's a whole long list of pieces of this story, the legal piece. What can we be looking forward to, and how this is playing out?
Honestly, I'm not sure we totally know at this point. I think there's a whole, as you said, there's a whole range of issues that are still out there, and I think we do believe that we're very much at the beginning of this issue. That this Bennett Omalu, when he opened up Mike Webster's skull in 2002, I mean, he just opened up a whole new world for our most popular sport, and that's just going to have ramifications for years to come. And we have all kinds of different interests in sort of where this is going, but in terms of what stories we're going to do, I don't think we totally know that.
Well, thank you so much. I think we've come to the end of our program. And thank you to our guests, Mark Fainru-Wada and Steve Fainru, ESPN investigative journalists and authors of the book, League of Denial, The NFL Concussions and the Battle for Truth. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of our speaker's book are on sale in the lobby, and they'll be pleased to sign books outside this room immediately following the program. We also appreciate you letting them make their way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Joan Ryan, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.